And the Lord spake, saying, first shalt thou take out the holy
cube.
Then shalt thou count to three.
Manna.
No more, no less. Three shall be the
manna
thou shalt count, and the number of the
manna
shall be three. Four shalt thou not count, neither count thou two, excepting that thou then proceed to three. Five
manna
is right out.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
Great. In that case,
I read your notes.
Well, you better not. That would ruin the surprise.
Okay.
I think that's.
I want to know the surprise.
I think that's a key to good podcasting: is always to surprise your co-hosts if they don't know what's going on and what's going to happen.
Be asymmetrically prepared.
One of my favorite podcast episodes ever is the episode of "You Look Nice Today," where Adam tells Merlin and the third host, whose name I've forgotten, on air that he's having a baby for the first time. It's very adorable.
Okay. I don't know if I ever listened to that podcast. I listened to some other
you should.
Other things in the Merlin Manaverse, but...
This is the one. You should definitely
that's
listen.
That's the one.
Yeah.
How much of the podcast do I need to listen to before that episode to get the context, to get the character development?
I think you should listen from the beginning.
Oh, okay. All of it.
It's not... There's not that many episodes relative to other shows, because Adam Lissagore very carefully, like, edited each episode.
He's the sandwich guy, right?
He is the sandwich guy, yes. Yeah, but he very carefully edited each episode. It's not just like a normal we talk into microphones show. It's got this like artful editing. Artful but very subtle editing by Adam that makes it feel like it's kind of off the cuff, but more beautifully. I don't know. It's hard to describe. But the show is evergreen. Absolutely holds up. Scott. That's the name of the third co-host. Scott. I've remembered. Anyway, did I say welcome to the show yet?
No. Like, there's... What? Is this the right one?
You look nice today.
I'll just leave this open like this. I can look at it later.
I'll send you the podcast for you.
Okay,
it's still
great.
In my podcatcher, and I'm never going to take it out ever.
Should we do our own podcast?
Yes. I think by this point, people have probably realized that Emma is not here. She was going to join us tonight, but something came up, wasn't able to join us. So you're stuck with just Anthony and I doing a good old-fashioned cube theory episode. Bread and butter. Back to our roots, Anthony, for episode 170.
Welcome. Great.
I just like to pause sometimes, give you a chance to talk, and then I edit out all those pauses, and I think people think that I just steamroll you, but I actually do pause quite a bit to see if you have something to say, and then you don't, and then I just keep talking. But people listen back to the episode, and I cut all that out to make it sound cleaner, you know?
Yeah, if you get the mixed pleasure of meeting me at KubeCon, you will discover that Andy edits me a lot.
No, I'm actually not editing you that much. I'm editing out the silence that I leave
okay,
for you.
I see.
Which you very strategically choose when to jump in on. You're like, you say very little, but it always hits really hard, you know? Excellent. Anthony, this episode's all about the mana curve of a cube. Mana value of an overall cube. Because, I think we mentioned this on a previous episode, but I was taken aback. Our friend, Magic the Gathering Data Science on Twitter, who we've talked about many times, is a big cube fan and has been doing an enormous thread on Twitter of various statistics about the featured cubes at KubeCon. I know you, Anthony, have delved into this exact subject yourself a little bit and played around with the statistics of all the 50 cubes that are featured in the event.
I have. I actually did a bunch a while before the lists were actually locked in, wrote some scripts, looked at some data, and I've been meaning to come back around that. Should I hold myself accountable? Should I set myself a,
hey, it's
a time bomb for myself that I will have this article published this weekend before KubeCon?
Okay.
So it should be up. When is this? Right now. You can go look at it.
Yes. This will come out on Monday, so it'll be up by then.
Great. Do I want to call that shot?
You just did.
I did. Okay.
And
go enjoy the article.
I refuse to edit it out. Anyway, most of these statistics have been interesting, but I would say that for the most part, I have been able to anticipate where my cube and your regular cube fall in all these tables. I'll be like, oh, here's the cubes based on the ones that have the most unique cards. Here's the cubes based on the ones that have mana curves or whatever. Like, it's always this like big table, and I think the cubes are kind of ranked by some arbitrary statistic.
Right, regular cube is always exactly in the middle.
Well, so this is what you might think, and this is what I would think on a lot of these tables, too. But the one table that surprised me was his table of the average mana value of all non-land cards in each of these cubes. And Bun Magic Cube is the number 3 lowest curving environment, which we mentioned when we reviewed this cube on our previous episode with Justin, and that was anticipated. I expected this because I like my cheap spells, and so I totally expected to be on the lower end of the curve. What I was surprised to find...
Three's really low. What is even beating that?
So what's beating it is the tempo cube, which I will admit I have not looked at in detail.
That makes sense.
And Gwen Decker's Tiny Leaders cube, which
it's got tiny in the name.
I believe Tiny Leaders is confined to 3 mana value and below. But there's an important thing to mention here, which is that this is based on Magic the Gathering data science, just pulling all of the card lists and then processing the data based on Scryfall statistics. So in my cube, I have a lot of cards that are on their face expensive, but are not actually expensive. So I've actually prepared a little list here of the highest mana value spells in my cube. This is all of the spells over 4 mana value in my entire cube. Are you ready?
Everything over 4.
Everything over 4.
Okay.
I'm going to read them all. It's not that long.
That's going to take a while, right?
You would think that, but no. So I have Treasure Cruise, Dig Through Time, Bedlam Reveler, Hogak, Virtue of Persistence, Murktide Regent, Tossiger, Embercleave, Shark Typhoon, Primeval Titan, Timeless Dragon, Teferi Temporal Pilgrim, Mystic Confluence, Primordial Mist, Titania Protector of Argoth, Nissa Who Shakes the World, Fracture Identity, Golos, Force of Will, and Storming Entity. And Terminus, which I forgot by accident.
I feel like maybe 6 of those do not have either a cost reduction mechanic or an alternate cost. 8. Okay, I missed a couple. I think Primeval Titan was the first one that I noticed.
Yeah, it is. There's only 8 cards of the top 20 there where you actually have to pay the mana cost to cast the card. It's like a hard mana restriction. And only one of those is above 5 mana value, and that is Primeval Titan. That is the only card above 5 mana value in my entire cube that you just have to cast. You know, I mean, obviously you could do some other hoops and maybe get it into play in some other ways, but the card itself has no other modes. Everything else that's above 5 mana value has Delve, it has some alternate casting costs, it has cycling, it has something that you can do with it other than cast it for the cost printed in the top right. And in most of those cards' cases, that is what you're doing with it. So I actually think that if you compare my cube to the Tiny Leaders cube, and I actually have not looked at the Tiny Leaders list in detail, but I would guess that if that is a hard restriction, you can't actually have any cards above 3 mana value, that mine is probably actually lower on average than the Tiny Leaders cube because I'm being thrown off by all of these high mana value spells that are not actually high mana value spells. So I would argue in practice, I'm maybe the second lowest cube. It doesn't matter. Look, I'm a really low cube.
Check out this data today in the article that I just wrote.
It'll be in the article you just wrote. We're also going to link to Magic the Gathering Data Science's Twitter thread and this tweet in particular, so you can look at this table for yourself. But we've kind of buried the lead here, Anthony. The thing that surprised me the most was that the 5th lowest curving cube of 50, I think maybe it was only 48 or 49 in here when he was doing this analysis, is your regular cube, which I was surprised by, and you were also surprised by, if memory serves.
Yeah, that is pretty surprising, because I do think of it as kind of like normal limited magic in a lot of ways, and I feel like that's going to fall into sort of, you know, the middle of what people are doing. But I guess that the best story I can tell myself is that a lot of people that are designing lower-powered things are also kind of interested in doing slower, bigger, splashier things. I mean, maybe that's a really a key thing, is just slower, whereas the power level in this abstract sense that's really difficult to pin down of the regular cube is pretty low. It is pretty quick. A lot of the games go pretty fast because of that low curve. I'm also sure that I'm just influenced a lot by your magic expectations in our playgroup.
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot of factors here. But honestly, I think the biggest factor, which I'm going to go out on a limb and make this argument in this podcast episode, is that a lot of people, just their curve is much too high in their cube and they should make it lower. To satisfy their design goals, to make their cube better at what they want it to be, I think lots of cubes have too high of a mana value, and we'll get to why. I have a couple of theories as to why. Like, I always describe my cube as a low-curving environment because I know it factually is. I don't think it plays, strictly speaking, like a low-curving environment. Like, compared to cubes that we've played that literally only have 2 mana value and below spells, in those environments, you do feel a lack of expensive spells. You feel, like, the absence of them in a way that really changes the texture of the gameplay.
I don't know if that's true, because when I played the 2CMC cube or less last year at KubeCon, I was like, oh yeah, this is like regular cube or Bun Magic cube. I'm missing like 3 or 4 top end cards, but otherwise this is kind of like a deck that I'd expect. I have mana sinks and my equipments and creature lands and things like that. So maybe that's just where our expectations
are
set differently. Yeah, I did okay.
I'm thinking of specifically a Patrick cube that has 2 mana value and less. I mean, obviously every 2 mana value less cube is going to have its own design restrictions, but I feel in those environments, not a lack of things to do with a bunch of mana, because like you said, mm-hmm. almost all of those cubes have mana sinks or whatever. They have ways to spend your mana later on in the game. I feel what I'm going to describe in this episode, the like lack of absolute power per card that you get from an environment like Bun Magic or other powerful cubes, where an individual card just has the ability to turn the game around entirely. We talked about this a little bit with regards to rarity restricted cubes too, because that is, I think, actually a better descriptor for what makes card rarity is the ability of that card to have a major absolute impact on the game, right? Like Lightning Bolt is printed a common. That's an incredibly powerful card. So to say that rarity and power are directly related, I mean, they're definitely correlated for sure, but I think that a lot of commons, I mean, my cube is chock full of commons. I have tons of common cantrips, tons of common burn spells, like, because at the end of the day, they're still one for one. They still have an absolutely small impact on the game compared to a card that has a much bigger, like, absolute impact, which is what you get from more expensive spells pound for pound.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of a I don't know exactly how loose or tight it is, but it is a way that Wizards thinks about the rarity of cards and the way that they design cards. It's pretty intentional that they'll think cards that interact with many targets at once, you know, that literally can say, destroy that, draw a card, bounce this, and you discard a card. That's always going to be a rare. And then things that maybe interact with two things you might see at uncommon, and things that really only interact with one other thing or just, you know, a single permanent in play that has one effect, those are the kinds of things you see at common. So that definitely makes sense. I do feel like that's changed a little bit recently, but you know, design is complicated.
But yeah, if they were gonna, I mean, I don't think they're gonna put Lightning Bolt in any set coming up anytime soon, but if they were, they wouldn't put it at mythic rare just because it's very powerful, right? Like, it, that's not really the main consideration for rarity. Anyway, all by means of saying, I do feel like there is a texture to low banded value cubes, and it might not be what people expect. I think we've said before that I think a lot of people expect aggro mirrors, like the game's gonna be over super fast, everyone's got cheap spells.
Okay, yeah, I've definitely had longer games in a lot of these types of environments,
right? You can have really long games that kind of come down to this like inevitability, just like, okay, well, we're both gonna have a bunch of two drops, and two drops are almost always gonna trade in combat, so the board's gonna get clogged pretty quickly, and we're all gonna have a lot of one for one removal for those two drops, but at two mana value and less, how many, you know, two for one removal spells do you get? Very, very few.
Yeah, or we both have our mana sink, our engine online, and it's going to take a while for the game to end, but there is kind of a deterministic way that eventually you're going to be able to go over the top of me with yours.
Yeah, it does come down, I think, to that kind
thinking
of inevitability.
Thinking about you, Theo.
Right, like who's got the Retrofitter Foundry, or like the thing that can actually just go over the top of...
I think I had the Retrofitter Foundry, and he had something bigger. I don't remember the details.
It's possible, it's possible. But my point is, and maybe I'll just ask you, like, do you think, if you were to, like, think about the gameplay experience of the Bun Magic Cube, that low curving is actually, like relative to Retail Limited, does it feel low curving to you?
I would say a little bit more. Like, in Retail Limited, and I haven't played that much Limited in the last couple of years,
but I feel
like...
You don't get as many playable one-drops and stuff.
You don't get as many... You didn't used to get as many playable one-drops, for sure. And I feel like you could also play some four and five-drops pretty easily, whereas I do feel like, especially in the Bun Magic Cube, playing four and five-drops is risky. Like, those cards might just mean you're dead because you don't have a cheaper interactive spell because your opponent is just going to be putting a ton of pressure on you. I also really felt
this...
It's
not even just a ton of pressure, too. It's like, to match the decks that do put a lot of pressure on, the control decks all have counter magic. So if you're planning to just like get to five lands and play a five drop, any deck with counter spells is going to have an answer for it, unless you've been also taxing their answers with other things along the way. So I don't know. I think it's really hard to describe in the abstract how these environments feel. And to say the Bun Magic Cube feels low curving, I don't think is quite accurate to me, because like you can definitely have super long games in the Bun Magic Cube that don't feel the same kind of like inevitability long as the games in like a in Patrick's two mana value or less cube, two below honey. And you can have big complicated board states, and you can have big stuff happen in that cube, even though I have very, very few by raw number actual big spells that you can do stuff with in the environment. Do you think your cube feels low curving?
Yeah, I mean, again, now I'm just wondering if that's such a useful descriptor. It feels like you need something to do in the first, at least second turn. If you're not doing something on turn two, you're probably going to be in a difficult spot, which is not how I feel in some other environments, which we don't play as many of those, frankly. But when I do, it's like, oh yeah, I can keep this hand that starts on turn three and not feel like I'm a complete doofus.
Maybe another way to think about it is when someone describes a cube as like really low curving, one of my expectations as a drafter is like, okay, maybe I should actually prioritize more expensive stuff higher, because,
yeah.
And in neither of our cubes do I ever feel like I'm lacking in big expensive endgame. Do you agree with that statement?
I agree with that.
Yeah. So even though our cubes are very low curving, I never feel like, oh, I just have no big stuff to do. Like, my deck is just, it's lacking in this, like, powerful endgame. I don't have anything to do with a lot of mana or late in the game or whatever. Those things are present. I think they're present in a plenty sufficient density to make those environments play, like, normal. I mean, like, obviously my cube is designed to be faster. It's designed to be more powerful. And that is related to the curve. But, like I said, you can definitely play a control deck full of 4 and 5 drops if you want. You need to play that deck knowingly in the context of a cube where you can't just play the 4 and 5 drops. They have to be what you do after you've already answered all the other stuff, because you can't just afford to wait around and do nothing for 4 turns. But you still get to play big planeswalkers here. Like, you've said in the show before, like, Teferi Temporal Pilgrim feels like a huge bomb in this environment in some ways, because if you look at absolute power level, like, all the cards in the cube, which ones affect the game the most when they are cast, regardless of their casting cost, right? Take the casting cost out of it for a second. Teferi is one of the most powerful cards.
Yeah, it draws a ton of cards while actually also making a bunch of huge threats.
Right. So it is, in some ways, a bomb in that sense. Which gets to my distinction here that I want to make between a card's absolute power level and its relative power level.
Relative to its mana cost?
Relative to its mana cost. So, again, in absolute terms, I'm just talking about the impact on the game. So, by absolute power definition, Lightning Bolt, Lightning Strike, Open Fire, identical power level. They do exactly the same thing. They all deal 3 damage to any target at instant speed. Cost is irrelevant.
I see how we're going to get to a spreadsheet here. I feel a spreadsheet coming on.
Actually, I don't have a spreadsheet about that.
You have a new way of tagging all the cards in your cubes and then making a bunch of graphs.
Oh, God, if only. If I had time to do all that. So that's absolute power level. And then there's relative power level, which is, I think, the way that people are way more used to talking about cards. If you ask a Magic player which of these 3 cards is more powerful, everyone's going to say Lightning Bolt. Because
reasonable.
Because it is more relatively powerful. It's the same overall impact for lesser mana. And as a player, it makes sense you should only really care about relative power level, because what good is a really powerful card if you never get to cast it, right? And so when you're building your decks, when you're evaluating cards for constructed or retail limited or whatever, you're always kind of looking at power level through this relative power level lens, which makes sense.
I feel like we're just getting around to talking about tempo versus value again, where it's like on the one extreme is everybody's going to, the game's going to be slow enough that everybody will have a chance to cast all their spells. So it just kind of matters who has bigger spells, more impactful spells. It doesn't really matter what they cost. Just flip your decks over and see who win is the extreme value end of the spectrum. And the reason you need all these cheap spells that are less impactful is because you can deploy them earlier in the game and figure out how you're navigating that sort of resource development, or navigating how you're keeping pressure on your opponent in order that they can't cast their spells and actually get the full value from those expensive spells.
That is part of this for sure. It's actually not where I'm going, though. So we have this distinction in relative and absolute power, and there's obvious reasons why players should only really care about relative power level. There's no use in having the argument of, like, which is more absolute power, Colossal Dreadmaw or Tarmogoyf? Well,
Emrakul's great in this cube that doesn't
time,
have a way to cheat it out or ramp into
it. Most of the time, Colossal Dreadmaw is more absolutely powerful than Tarmogoyf, but Tarmogoyf can be bigger, but Colossal Dreadmaw's got Trample. Like, that's a discussion we could have in this alternate universe where people actually cared about absolute power level, but for very good reasons they don't. I think, as a cube designer, you really should care about absolute power level, because your players are going to draft their cube. They're going to build their decks. They are going to be responsible for applying this relative power level lens, right? They're not going to just draft a deck full of 5 and 6 drops and then, you know, do nothing until turn 5 or 6, unless the environment allows that, and then maybe they will. You have to trust your players to basically navigate the environment and try to win in good faith. You, as the cube designer, you are creating an environment which is going to determine essentially, like, what the texture of games are, and importantly, how games are going to end. And I think if you take a look across an entire cube and look at where, like, the concentrated absolute power is, I think that is very likely going to be, in a lot of cases, how games are decided, is by the cards that have a lot of absolute power, or that you're able to make have lots of absolute power. You know, look at a card like Young Pyromancer. How much absolute power does it have? It's variable. It depends entirely on the deck it's in, whether it gets removed after 1 turn or 10 turns. If you can build a deck that can make Young Pyromancer into a card that has a huge amount of absolute power, then you'll probably win that game. Or if you could just get to the point where you can cast Inferno Titan and it sticks for a turn, you win that game too, because that's also a lot of absolute power entirely concentrated in a card.
I don't know if I agree with that, though, because, like, Goblin Guide sucks, and if we talk about it in those terms, it's like card negative. If your opponent gets a 2/3 in play, suddenly the card just doesn't do anything. It's only valuable because it actually can put pressure on your opponent early before they can actually do bigger things.
Yeah, it's not, this is not a, like...
But that is a card that will end games, right? So if you're talking about what are the cards that are going to be... Like, I feel like you're going towards this place of thinking, like, look towards the end, look at what's going to end the game, and then you can finish, sort of fill in how that's going to dictate the whole structure of things. But I think that, you know, Goblin Guide just sort of breaks that theory because it is a card that's also going to end games.
Well, it has a role in ending games for sure, right? I, what I'm trying to argue is, like, I can see this thing in my head, and I'm such a visual person, it's hard mm-hmm. to describe things with words.
Why
sometimes.
Did you choose to do a podcast?
Because I also love to talk, and video is way harder to do, way more work. What I'm basically arguing is that who's going to win the game is the person that can deploy the most absolute power over the course of the game, right? Which is where you say, well, okay, well, how can we determine how much they can deploy? Let's look at the relative power level, how castable things are. And that is certainly a factor, but, like, I think, for example, if you dropped Inferno Titan in the Bun Magic Cube, how good would it be? Win percentage-wise, I don't think very good. I think you put it in your deck, and you are going to lose a lot of the time because you're just going to be down a card for most of the game, right? You essentially mulliganed to six, at least, until you get to six mana, which is very, very late in the game in the Bun Magic Cube, and you can't afford to play down a card that long. But also, if you get to resolve it, you just win, right? Like, there's not as many answers for a card like Inferno Titan in the Bun Magic Cube. It's going to outrace everything because everything else is small. And so it's going to have this, like, very swingy impact that I feel like people don't give cards that cost more than three mana value the recognition of, like, how inherently swingy just having four and five mana value spells that are appropriately powerful for their cost in a given cube is.
I'm still not sure I'm convinced, because there's also the Vindicate test, which I know you've written an article about, and a card like Inferno Titan does a lot if it sticks around, and it is relevant that it also does a lot just by entering the battlefield. But if we talk about Earl of Squirrel, which has to not only be cast, resolve, and get into combat, if your opponent has a cheap removal spell that can kill it, you're just way down on resources.
Yeah.
So it's a card with a huge absolute power level. Earl of Squirrel can do a whole lot, but it's really not that good in the regular cube because of this tempo axis.
So let's talk about Earl of Squirrel.
Okay, I'd love to.
Why do you include Earl of Squirrel in the regular cube? Is it, are you just going to say because you like squirrels?
Yes.
Is that really the whole reason? Like, do you think if Earl of Squirrel was flavored as something that wasn't squirrels, there it wouldn't be in the cube?
That'd be very likely, yeah. I mean, it has Squirrel Link. That's really good.
Okay, let's pick another expensive spell so we can actually have this conversation. Newscraft Mob. Kind of similar space, right? I mean, it's got a little value against removal in that you get a single zombie token.
Yep.
So a little better than Earl Squirrel in that sense. We can talk about Honored Hydra that has more value against removal too. What's another big spell in your cube that you think plays similarly to Earl of Squirrel?
That plays similarly to Earl of Squirrel.
Even if it's better or worse, just has like similar, like, if it sticks, you're doing great. If they remove it, you're doing awful kind of
play
pattern.
Well, this is difficult because there are also just not that many expensive spells in the regular cube. I mean, maybe Archfiend of Ifnir is the next best one that, like, it's a big threat.
That's a pretty good example.
Going to put a lot of pressure, but your opponent can't just remove it. A couple of the other expensive things just operate on weird other ways. Like, Bolas's Citadel is definitely not just if you cast this, you can win.
Yeah, it's definitely not.
It's pretty risky and... What else is that expensive in here?
Yeah, some things. I think Archfiend of Ifnir is a good example.
All right, let's talk about Archfiend of Ifnir.
So,
big flying demon. If you cycle stuff, you put -1/-1 counters on your opponent's creatures.
Yeah. So, basically, in the way it plays in the regular cube is that its base rate is fine. 5/4 flyer for 5. If you
pretty
can't
good.
Answer, it is really good.
Expensive, but pretty good.
And, you know, cards that demand answers from your opponent are decent. And oftentimes, if you drafted your deck right, if you get to untap with it, it's also effectively Plague Wind. I've definitely seen people and myself untap with Archfiend of Ifnir. You cycle two cards, and you essentially wipe your entire opponent's board. Maybe they're left behind with a 3/3 with two -1/-1 counters on it, but, like, what is that actually doing anymore? So the value is very high if you get to untap and you have your discard or cycling cards in your hand. What is the role that you see Archfiend of Ifnir playing in this cube?
So intentionally in this environment, there are not a ton of ways to discard to it, so it's a little bit hard to get there, so it's kind of there to give people, not on the scale of the Live the Dream cube, but on the regular cube scale of a little dream.
And presumably you are happy with the swingy play pattern of tap out for your 5-drop, either untap and probably win the game, or maybe they have Obnixilus's Cruelty or whatever cheapest removal spell that can actually remove Archfiend of Ifnir is in your cube, Oblivion Ring or whatever, and you just get kind of blown out on tempo.
Yeah, I mean, it is all relative because the regular cube is very much focused on not having, like, big swingy, snowball-y, take-over-the-game type effects. And Archfiend Mjolnir kind of stands out as being a unique thing here because of that. And I think it is because it does take some investment. It does take some work in the draft to be able to make that happen that I'm okay with. Every once in a while, you're going to have that game that's pretty one-sided.
I mean, I do think that if you take any other card that is 4-mana valued up, it's a similar-ish play pattern, right? Like, if you get to untap with Newscraft Mob, you're also doing great. If you get to untap with Maya, Bredegar Protector, or, you know, whatever, like, these cards are going to take over games. I mean, and this is not a criticism, right? This is just an observation that, like, yes, your expensive cards are going to do more than your cheaper cards, right?
I totally agree with that.
Okay, great. So my suggestion is just that the more expensive cards you have, the more difficult it is for a collection of cards with lower absolute value, your Goblin Guides and your whatever, to actually overcome that power level and win the game, right? The more 4 and 5 drops you have that just shut the door and demand an answer and are, you know, huge bombs, and even not ones, right? Like, even you could say that in your cube, Moldrifter has a high absolute power level because it's draw 2 and make a 2/2 flyer, even though it's not in this, like, Baneslayer-y way where it's like if you untap with it, you go crazy.
Sure, just generating resources is still an impact on the game that's right. Important.
It's still just a very powerful thing to be doing at that mana value in this cube. Do you then follow my logic that if you have a bunch of those running around, then a lot of people that tried to start on Goblin Guides or whatever and are trying to out-tempo you are going to run into these big bombs and lose the game because of it, or have the game turned around more frequently because of it?
I feel like we're sort of getting to something that I'm having trouble getting my head around, which is sort of like the curve of the cube and optimal curves of decks that are drafted in it. And what I don't think is the case is in the regular cube, if you just say all these 4-mana spells are much more impactful, I'm just going to draft all these 4 or 5-mana spells and I will have a better deck than my opponent. I definitely don't think that's true. I think that the optimal curve of decks in this environment is just lower curving than in some other cubes. So maybe part of what you're about to advocate for is sort of getting those two in line and lowering your curve to what the optimal curve is. But I don't really have a great sense. I'm not a good enough or experienced enough player to say what really dictates what makes the optimal curve in a deck.
Well, it's hard because I'm trying to, like, separate the player experience from, like, the broader designer perspective, right? Like, yes, as a player, you always have to be conscious of your curve, and you will hear cube designers rail on, you know, big Baneslayers or expensive cards that don't have a major Enter the Battlefield ability or whatever because they fail the Vindicate test and they're just, like, not good. But the reality is, if you put Baneslayer Angel in your cube, well, that's just probably too powerful for your cube, but if you put Baneslayer Angel in my cube, it would win plenty of games. Like, it would just happen sometimes. The reason it's not in my cube is not because Baneslayer Angel is bad. It's because it's not the kind of gameplay I want to encourage. What I'm suggesting is that most cubes have way more cards that are much swingier that the designers, if you ask them what their goals were, they would say they don't want those kinds of swingy games. But that's just inherent in having so many expensive spells, right? So you could design a cube where you have these expensive spells and you just try and make them bad by having tons of Goblin Guides and, like, you know, making the environment really aggressive. Put Baneslayer Angel in, but also put all the Doomblades you can get your hands on in. And you're still going to have some games where Baneslayer Angel just wins, right? Like, it just happens. Like, I guess I'm trying to argue for this, like, holistic view of a cube and saying, if you put Baneslayer Angel in a cube, it's going to win games. Doesn't really matter what cube it is. Like, at some point, it's going to win games. It's going to be really hard to make an environment where that card is just literally never going to do anything. And I think the same is true of almost any card. So when you look at a cube and you just kind of take a broad sampling of the cards of the highest absolute power level, the fact of putting them in the cube is that that absolute power is going to be felt at some point. They are going to win games, right? Otherwise, it's definitely possible to have a card that has a high absolute power level that its impact is not felt, and people aren't going to play it. Like, your players are not dumb. They're just not going to put it in their deck, i.e. Earl of Squirrel.
Yeah, you know I'm thinking about Earl of Squirrel.
I could just put Emrakul in the Bun Magic Cube. There's literally nothing to do with it there. It is, like, I guess you could play it if you wanted a way to reshuffle your deck somehow, but it's a non-card in the Bun Magic Cube. So even though it has a bunch of absolute power, that's irrelevant because your players are not going to put it in their decks. If that's the case, you should cut the card. If the card is there and people are playing it, then it's going to have its power felt at some point. Its absolute power level is going to shape the environment. And I think the absolute power level, the, like, gravitational well of having one Inferno Titan, has a way bigger impact on an environment than the vacuum created by having one Goblin Guide, right? We can talk about why maybe Goblin Guide is a better card, a more relatively powerful card than Inferno Titan, right? It certainly has a longer constructed pedigree than Inferno Titan has, so if that's a barometer by which we measure relative power level, then yeah, that's a more relatively powerful card. And I think cube designers are so often focused on how powerful is my cube. Like, that's my metric, is I want to include cards that are, like, of a relatively narrow relative power level band. And you could argue that Goblin Guide and Inferno Titan are pretty similar in the relative power level, right? They may be part of a cube that has a very flat power level design goal, but the impact of those cards is totally different on the actual environment in a way that I think we don't talk about a lot as cube designers. I mean, we were surprised to find, at least I was surprised to find, that we have never done a podcast episode where we talked about the mana curve or the mana value of our cubes ever in 170 episodes, which is wild to me.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is really important. It dictates the way a lot of the gameplay works. I'm kind of trying to think through what you're saying, and definitely something we have talked about for sure is how the most aggressive potential deck in an environment kind of sets the tempo, because
yeah,
everybody kind of has
sure.
to know, like, you might face that deck, so be prepared, have your cheap removal, and, like, maybe you'll sideboard some of that out against certain opponents, but that is, you know, there's one person asking the first questions and you got to be prepared to answer or you're just not gonna be able to 3-0.
I think maybe even more comprehensively than that, it's not even just that there's one deck and you might face it, it's that
all of your opponents
are also thinking, well, I might face that deck. And it results in, like, very often the most aggressive deck sets the tempo for the entire table.
Right.
Like, the most aggressive deck dictates what types of counterspells are viable in a way that you're like, what is my control deck? Like, I have board wipes. Why do I care if I can play Mana Drain or Spell Snare or whatever? But the speed of that aggressive deck is going to dictate the viability of, like, every other card in a way that, like, really is comprehensive of the environment.
Right, right. It's that initial benchmark, and then there's game theory that happens.
Yes.
But is there also a different game theory that happens when someone says, I might cast Inferno Titan at you, how are you going to deal with that? And people are, as much as they're focused on the early game, they also have to think about the late game and figure out how they're going to beat some of these huge things that are just going to have a lot of absolute impact on the game.
I mean, I think it's definitely true. I mean, full transparency, this is coming on the back of me over the past couple weeks at Cube Night, drafting other powerful, like, eternal cubes that have a lot of the same cards as the Bun Magic Cube, a lot of the same cards as the Magic Online Vintage Cube, but are not the Bun Magic Cube. And I've drafted these two cubes back-to-back kind of like I was drafting the Bun Magic Cube. I evaluated cards the same way because I had never played either environment before, and I was, like, kind of coming in blind, and I was like, all right, well, I'll take cheap interaction or whatever. And I ended up with really low curving decks in both cubes, and in both cubes, I just lost whenever my opponent played a 5-drop, and my deck was not consistently fast enough because I wasn't really an aggro deck in either environment, to be clear. Like, I was drafting a low curving deck expecting a certain tempo that just wasn't really there because they had so much weight at the top end. And I think people often hyper-focused on, like, how can I make the, like, cheap decks good? And for some reason, the simple answer of just cut a bunch of your 5 and 6 drops never really gets floated. I think it's because, from a player perspective, you're like, well, these are high risk. They're, like, they're not actually that good, right? Like, Inferno Titan is not warping my environment because it's so powerful, because you could just Doomblade it or whatever. But it actually does warp things in a big way, because you then have to play in an environment where you have to be anticipating that your opponents might just be doing this thing. And I don't even know, maybe there were other aggro decks at this table that were just stomping all of my opponents, where my low curving kind of, like, tempo-y deck that was not purely aggressive was
not
totally
a, not
floundering.
Not the table I was at. I was there casting Inferno Titan.
Right. You had Inferno Titan in your deck, and, you know, my opponent just cast Consecrated Sphinx. And, like, I don't think Consecrated Sphinx is a very powerful card on relative terms, but absolutely, of course, it's ridiculously powerful. And I got them to 6, then they cast Consecrated Sphinx, and it's like, I have, like, 2 answers to this in my deck, and I need to just draw one now, I guess.
But there are 2 kind of questions that you're asking at the same time. One is, what is the way we create certain types of gameplay through the mana curve? And the other is, what kind of gameplay are people actually looking for? You're kind of insinuating that people do want this lower to the ground, cheaper, more tempo-y kind of gameplay, but I kind of liked casting Inferno Titan.
Well, everybody likes being the one casting the Inferno Titan and, like, getting to attack their opponent with it. But I see all the time people talking about wanting their cubes to be balanced or skill testing or flat power level or, like, all these terms, like, where people are trying to craft environments where you essentially can very reliably, with a sum of a bunch of cards that have a small absolute power level sequenced and played in the right order, overcome what would be otherwise big bombs out of your opponents. So I see these goals articulated a lot, and I do actually think that a lot of more variety of gameplay is possible at low curves than people give credit for.
Okay, there I think you said something pretty interesting, where it's like, it is really fun to draft an environment where you have a lot of small components that add up to be more than the sum of their parts. And that might be through just a tempo advantage, that might be through explicit synergies between cards,
right.
But you get some extra value from skillful or thoughtful or difficult sequencing and things like that, and difficult deck building. And on the other hand, you have these cards that just, if you are allowed to spend 6 mana, one card will do more than those two other components together. So it's just
or
kind
seven
of like
other components
the
together.
Opposite of it. Yeah, it's just like this one card, if given the time, will be better than your cool little synergies.
Right. I don't know a lot of people who at least articulate verbally that is what they want their cube to be.
When was the last time you played Commander?
I mean, it's been a long time.
It's been a long... because a lot of people do want that.
I mean...
there is the Live the Dream
cube.
What
I think about Commander decks, though, I feel like they're all about synergy. They are not about just resolving big cards. Like, they are much bigger games because people don't like removal and they don't... you have this, like, social contract thing about, like, not attacking people or whatever. Like, the games are huge because of the multiplayer nature of the games, but Commander is, like, inherently this insanely synergistic format where I don't think if you just had individual... like, people complain all the time about Dockside Extortionist, Thassa's Oracle, Smothering Tide, these individual cards that do actually have a big swing on the game because they want their deck that's made of a bunch of synergistic parts to be able to thrive.
Okay, you're right. People do want different things from Commander, but it was... like, it's inciting headline was this is the environment where you can play your cool 6 and 7 drops that do big splashy stuff. Like, I think that's what really initially got people into it. There's all kinds of other things that really are appealing about the format, but I think that's what a lot of people that are designing Commander cubes are looking for as well, is recapturing some of that more less synergistic but more big splashy back and forth experience. Which, again,
sure.
is what's great about Cube, is that you can sort of focus on recapture whatever kind of experience you want and exclude the particular parts that aren't contributing to that experience.
Right, and for all of you that are listening and you're like, I want to play Baneslayer Angel or I want to play Earl of Squirrel and have the person get removal checked and have the game end that way, this obviously does not apply to you. Like, go forth, do your thing. But for people listening that describe their goals as wanting to be skill testing, drafting decks that are more than the sum of their parts, whether it be, again, through explicit synergies or just managing the tempo of the game in an interesting way, I just think that tons of cubes have a way higher curve than is justified for their goals. Ugh, this conversation ended up being so much more scatterbrained than I would have liked. I want to add a couple more thoughts here in the editing booth. Not too much, because I'd really prefer to have this conversation with Anthony rather than just be speaking into a void. Maybe we'll come back to this topic in the future, but I feel like a lot of this conversation ended up focusing on the potentially negative impacts of expensive cards, when we also could have focused just as much on the value of cheap cards and how rewarding it is to combine a bunch of cards of low absolute power level to create a strategy that is of a higher power level than some of its parts. I think that style of deck can actually cover lots of different types of gameplay, whether you prefer really aggressive, fast games or highly synergistic, long, engine-y style games. I think a lot of these things can be supported by almost entirely cheap cards. Really what it comes down to is, a lot of times I feel like the higher mana value cards in people's cubes are not actually playing specific roles. They're just like filling in what the designer believes to be the ideal curve, right? There's some perception that you have to have a certain amount of 4s and 5s and 6s. You see this all the time on Reddit and stuff when people are like, what are your black 5s? It's like, I haven't had one in years. I don't have any black 5s. I don't think that's a relevant question to be asking. I think expensive spells with a lot of absolute power level are very volatile, and if you are just including them without having specific roles in mind, specific jobs they're doing that can't be done by cards of a lower mana value, then you really run the risk of them either being too expensive and too risky to be good, in which case they're just not played, and that's not great, or they are good enough to single-handedly negate an entire synergistic strategy consisting of low absolute power level cards. And I think that's what I felt when I saw these numbers from KubeCon, that not only was the Bun Magic Cube among the lowest curving cubes in the entire event, but so was the regular cube. And these are cubes that play very differently. They're very different power levels, very different speeds of games, but neither of them feel at all deficient in top end, in late game threats, in that raw absolute power. That in combination with the fact that both Anthony and I have just lowered the curves of our cubes over the years and never really looked back, just makes me wonder if there's a lot of space taken up by expensive cards that are not necessary. And it's not just that the higher mana value cards can sometimes end up preying on those smaller decks. It's that every expensive card you include is also one less cheap card you included. It makes it harder to draft those decks that are made up of a bunch of small pieces because there's fewer cards running around for you. And eventually you're just forced to play the expensive stuff because you can't draft enough playables out of cheap cards, and you end up just having to play 3 and 4 and 5 drops, whether you think your strategy wants those style of cards or not. I mentioned my recent poor performance in a couple of drafts of high-powered cubes, and maybe a lot of you think that this whole topic is just cope for my poor performance in these two drafts. I just did a bad job, right? I didn't evaluate the environments correctly, but in one of them specifically, the designer of the cube said that they really liked my deck and thought it was cool and wanted it to be successful, and that just feels like a very common sentiment to me, where the decks that are relying on many smaller pieces to function, be it in a synergistic way or just in a taking advantage of tempo way, oftentimes just feel a lot more sought after than just, I played a couple lands and then dropped a 4 and a 5 drop back to back, and my opponent only had one removal spell instead of 2. Anyway, we'll carry on with the episode, but just wanted to get a couple other ideas out there that I feel like got buried in my scrambled brain. Let me keep going.
How mad are you going to get if I design regular cube thick version after this conversation?
I have a lot of points to touch on here. First, I want to like actually clarify how different the curves are in like our cubes and the average cube at CubeCon, because I think we should like clarify what we're talking about here. So Anthony's now looking at a graph, which it's not really worth sharing this graph, I don't think, but I've just visualized.
You actually drew a picture of this graph that you shared in the MTG Cube Talk Discord.
No.
Not this intentionally, but you drew this curve the other day.
Oh, sure. This curve comes up a lot.
It comes up a lot.
It's got a name. I forget what it is. Anyway,
It's sort of sloping up to the right, but it's got a sharp up at the end and a sharp down at the beginning.
Yeah. It's
got a little squiggle.
Math heads are going to... Wait, I'll farm engagement. Comment down below if you know the name of this type of curve that is very common in statistics. All I did here was just graph the actual values from that Magic Gathering Data Science tweet, just to show visually the distribution of all the different curves across CubeCon. Like you said, Live the Dream Cube is just like head and shoulders above pretty much everything else. And then down here we have like the Bun Magic Cube, the Tempo Cube, the Tiny Leaders Cube. And then yours, well, low is still kind of like closer to like that plateau where like you're not super far off from the, you know, the mode of the average cubes at CubeCon or the mean of the average cubes at CubeCon, but you are, you know, on the lower side. But here's the thing. So the average mana value of the Bun Magic Cube, according to the Magic the Gathering data science calculations, was 2.2. This was the one that just took the actual printed mana value, according to Scryfall, into consideration. I actually have the cards sorted on my cube list on CubeCobra by what I believe to be their effective mana value for the most part, and that adjusted average comes out to 1.98, which is quite a bit lower. Your regular cube averages 2.4, according to Magic Gathering Data Science's numbers, and I checked your average on CubeCobra.
I believe that to be accurate. There's no shenanigans here. You're not cheating anything. You're not delving.
Yeah, I checked your score on CubeCobra as well, and I think it was 2.39, so the same number basically there. The average cubes, I would say most of the cubes then at CubeCon fall between 2.6 and 3 is like, that covers 4/5 of all the cubes fall between like that range of average mana values. So just, you know, 2/10 of a mana value higher than your average and a couple points higher than mine. But I think people might look at these numbers and misinterpret how big the difference between, you know, a cube with an average mana value of 2.2 and a cube with an average mana value of 2.7 is, because of a couple reasons. One, the mana value here is like a linear change, right? Like the difference between 2.2 and 2.7 is some like linear adjustment. But when you actually play Magic, the mana value on spells, as we know, is not actually a linear adjustment, right? Like, the difference between a 1 and 2 mana spell is not the same as the difference between a 3 and 4 mana spell or a 7 and 8 mana spell, because as the game goes on, you're less likely to have X lands on X turn, right? So, turn 1, I imagine pretty much every cube in existence, you're going to have your first land, because that's how Magic works. Turn 2, I also imagine almost every cube, probably, you're going to hit your second land drop on turn 2. I think turn 3 is where it starts to get different.
Yesterday, and I cast Inferno Titan that game.
I have definitely kept one Landers in the Bun Magic Cube, missed a land for a turn or two, and still been fine. So I think there's maybe a little bit, maybe we go to like 92%.
97.
Sure, something like that there. And then I think when you get to 3 and 4 lands, that's where cube environments really start to differ. Some environments you like Live a Dream Cube, I imagine if you're not hitting your 4th land drop, you're really doing something wrong.
Whereas, yeah, maybe even 5th.
Whereas in the Bun Magic Cube, you can win whole games without ever playing your 4th land. So I think that's where the environments really start to differ. One like dumb measure of this we can do is people have done this before. This is like the hypergeometric math for if you just assume 17 lands in a 40 card deck and you're drawing one a turn. So forget any kinds of cantrips or fetch lands or cycling, or forget all that stuff. Just average it out. Then your chances of having a one land on turn one on the play is like 98%. On the draw, it's 99%. And the numbers go down kind of quickly in an accelerating fashion. So by the time you get to 3 lands, you're only 85% to have it on the play and 90% to have it on the draw. And 6 lands, you're 38% to have it on the play and 50% to have it on the draw. Which is all just a way of quantifying the fact that the absolute power level difference between a like one mana value card, like let's imagine hypothetical cards at the same relative power level. So, you know, just apply numbers to this thing, Ben Stark style. You've got a one drop that has one power, you've got a two drop that has two power, you've got a three drop that has three power, right? Theoretically, playing 3 1 drops in that situation should be as good as playing a three drop. But in reality, the way that Magic cards are balanced, it doesn't actually work that way, because if you actually balance things like that, then all your 5 and 6 drops would be unplayable, because you're just not going to have 5 or 6 lands on time enough for them to be to matter. So you need to get rewarded for that input by having a card that is actually a much higher absolute power level to make sense. Like, that's just how Magic cards are designed. Does it make sense? I know you know this too. Can you describe that in a better way than I'm describing it?
No, and it's been a long time since I've been thinking about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You surprised me. It's all about surprising,
it's all about surprising your guests. Your guess. It's so important. Basically, like, if you take a cube with average mana value 2 and a cube with average mana value 3, it's not that everything is going to be 50% more expensive. I mean, it is literally, but when you actually play the games, because on some turns you're not going to have your third mana on turn 3, it's going to have a more outsized impact on the game, because you are going to be that much, like, everything just gets less reliable, right? Like, as you go up the curve, you're just getting less and less likely to actually cast your spells on time. So you take all of the other factors of the cube and you just mix in more of this variance or more of this just inherent noise that comes from playing higher on the curve. So basically, I'm arguing that as the mana value increases, the speed of the format slows down at a greater rate. And by the speed of the format, I just mean the speed at which you can cast spells, not necessarily the speed at which you win games. I mean, ultimately, I'm arguing that power level, speed, and average mana value are all correlated, but not directly. And you can conceive of an environment with any combination of those knobs turned to any point, and that environment can exist. You can have an environment that is really long games and really low curving, or, you know, whatever. You can, like, sort it, you can figure out some combination of those things, and no matter what, you can design a cube to match those parameters. I have an example of this, actually. So I added a couple other cubes to this graph, just notable cubes. So I added my adjusted cube here, and I also added the Pauper cube, which comes in at 2.7. I added White Wolf's cube, which comes in also at 2.7. The current version of the Magic Online Vintage cube comes in at 3.1. So
that's sort of the top of that plateau, right?
Yeah, very, very high curving environment. And again, I think the difference between 2.2 and 3.1 is enormous. I think it's like, it can't be overstated how big that gap is. I mean, just think about how much longer you have to go on average in that other environment before you can be multi-spelling, right? Like, it just changes things in a really dramatic way. I added one other cube that I know is beloved and well-known, which is Caleb Gannon's Powered Synergy Cube, which is lower curving than everything on this list and comes in at 1.89 average mana value. I watched Caleb play a lot of this cube. I don't play a Magic Online, so I haven't played it myself. But this cube was not fast. This cube did not have abundance of aggro decks that were trying to get you dead really quickly. This cube was extremely synergistic. The games were often very long and convoluted and complicated. And most importantly, this cube, I think, like the Bun Magic Cube and like the Break of the Cube, does not feel like what I think a lot of people would assume a cube that has an average mana value of less than 2 would feel like. You're doing big, splashy things in that cube by design. That is what you're supposed to be doing. You're supposed to be combining these cards in these weird ways and building these cool engines and recurring your Scourge of Nel'Toth over and over again to trigger your Bridge from Below. Like, you are doing really ambitious things. I think this is just one point to my argument that you can have cubes that are designed across a wide variety of goals with a really low curve in this example. And you could do the same thing with a really high curve, but that's not what I'm arguing for right now. I'm arguing for everybody pursuing their same goals, but at an even lower curve than they're doing now. And it occurred to me that, you know, we haven't talked about mana curve as an episode before, partially because I've never really thought about it in the abstract. With every cube change I've made for the past 6 years, I've just tried to lower the curve more and more, and I've never felt like that was the wrong decision.
Yeah, I don't know what to think about at this point. Like, I feel like my motivations for lowering the curve in regular cube, which I've also done since the beginning, were not necessarily just because in the abstract, like, lower curve equals better, but it was mostly to solve some, like, really specific problems. Like,
well, right, no,
green didn't really have an identity. Okay, let's, like, force a more aggressive lower curve in green deck. That's a way to solve that problem. Sort of like five-color soupy decks were a little bit too rampant. People were just like kind of splashing and doing wonky things, and games were going on too long. Okay, we can solve that kind of cluster of issues by just making more aggressive decks that can actually put pressure on people to, yeah, set that tone and have those cascading effects. It's also just nice to be able to double spell more frequently and have up the mana to be able to, you know, do your cool synergistic during combat thing is much easier to do when you have cheaper spells to do it with. So, like, it wasn't a direct result of I just abstractly want a lower curve, but it was just a way to get to some of these other goals.
No, for sure. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I also didn't say I abstractly want a lower curve, but at every point, solving every problem I was trying to solve with my cube, the answer was always lowering the curve, right? Like, I was having problems with these swingy cards, and it was like, well, do I try and introduce more answers for them? No, I just cut them. Just, yeah, I played Inferno Titan for a long time, and it was always very swingy, and it got worse and worse on average, but was still winning games sometimes and still totally turning around games that people had no right to win except they happened to have their last card be Inferno Titan.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is just setting expectations. If you have this context where you're sitting down and the draft speech is, better draft your disfigure because you're going to need to do something about the cheap threats, and then somebody just plays Inferno Titan, that's really going to break people's expectations and not set them up to have a good time. If you're sitting down and it's like, get ready, there's going to be some Titans. Hope you're ready to do stuff on turn six that's bigger than what your opponent's doing on turn six, then sure, if people are prepared, they're going to have a much better time.
Right, that's true no matter what. I'm just saying that I think it's very common for cube designers, regardless of their goals, to end up lowering their curve naturally over time. And I'm just suggesting that people maybe jump ahead a couple iterations. Just assume that trend's going to continue. I don't know what I'm advocating for in specifics, because everybody's cube is different, and I'm not trying to like tell people what to do with their cubes.
I think maybe it's good to advocate for asking these kinds of questions.
Yeah, because I think what it comes down to, right, like, I feel kind of similar to this, like I feel about the lands conversation, which I have done so much more thinking and research and like hard work on to make that argument, the like how many lands you should include in your cube, which I reread that article every once in a while because I'm going to like send it to somebody as a reference. I'm like, does this still hold up? And I'm still really proud of that article. I think it makes a lot of sense and is a really good resource. So if you haven't read it, you should check it out. I feel emotionally similar about this issue that I do about the land issue. I just don't have all of the ways to back it up that I had about the land thing at that time. And I feel like if I was to do all that work, I could maybe make a similarly convincing argument that regardless of your cube goals, cutting all of your cards above 5 mana just in half, just cut half of them, and see if that actually leaves a vacuum that your players are asking, like, well, where are the powerful cards? Where did they come? I didn't ever see them, because I really don't think it will. And I also think that if you're playing with modern power level cards and your goal is like some version of power maxing, 3-drops go so far these days. Like, 3-drops do so much. Look at your Adelines, your Seasoned Pyromancers, your Lelias, or whatever. Like, it does not feel like you are winning the game with a combination of small cards when you win the game with Adeline, right? Adeline feels like a 5-drop in
a combination of small cards that all came out of the same card.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely... So how does this fit with you? Because I see a lot of people that are like brand new cube designers, like, hey, I play a lot of limited, I play some commander, I heard about cube, here's my first crack at it, I just like put a bunch of cards that I thought were cool in this list. And I agree, I always see there's like 5 5-drops in each color and a bunch of 6-drops and a bunch of 7-drops, and I'm like, okay, what kind of curve do you expect to see in the kinds of decks you enjoy playing, and kind of make the whole cube fit that. And usually for most people that I have that conversation with, the result is like, yeah, I'm not going to play 6 5-drops in my deck, so sure, I'll cut down the number in my cube, but it's not based on this abstract, this is how a curve should look. It's based on their expectation of what their decks should look like in their environment.
Right. I think a big part of what it comes down to is kind of something that the lands question has to push against too, which is that people don't want to cut quote-unquote cards that do things for more lands. Like, if you have a cube and you've been playing it, and in the abstract, so many people look at existing cube lists to inform what they're going to make for their own cube for the first cube they make. So in some sense, you do already have a cube. It's the Magic Online Vintage Cube. That's the cube you know, and so if you're going to make your own cube, you kind of start in the abstract from that starting point, it feels bad to cut cards that do things in quotes for lands, because you're like, well, this is my cube just has less in it. It has less cards that do things in it. I feel like I have like loss aversion for taking stuff out. I think that same loss aversion is there for expensive cards. It's like they do more. Like you're cutting out, your cube does less now because you're taking out these cards that do so much, right? Like there's only so much one and two drops can do just by the virtue of their mana cost. And so I think people feel bad, and the natural inclination, even though I do think over time people end up lowering the curve of their cube almost universally, I do think the inclination every time is just a little bit of like regret to be like, I'm taking out a five drop for this two drop, right? It just feels bad because the five drop is so cool and it does all these awesome things and it's got this synergy, and the two drop is whatever the two drop is. I think these forces slow the like progress of people towards actually finding what their ideal curve is, which from playing a lot of cubes in our local play group and at KubeCon last year, I'm going to play more at KubeCon again this year. I just feel like everybody is floating a little higher than they actually sound like they want to be based on their described goals. And I think cubes like Caleb Gannon's powered Vintage Cube go a long way to, and that cube is beloved, and I never saw anybody talk about that cube as like it's mega low curving. That was not the identifiable, like salient flavor of that cube. The flavor of that cube was all the crazy cool synergy stuff you could do. And part of the way that I think Caleb made that work was just making all the spells cheap so everyone got to do their synergies on the same timelines, right? And you weren't like playing 2 5 drops that synergize together, because that's just a totally different tempo and expectation than people that are putting together engines of, you know, 1 and 2 mana spells that do things together.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really interesting point, because if you do have a lot of these cheap spells that don't do a lot of their own, but then you combine them, it does something cool, you're not necessarily going to be able to scale that up and say, like, these 2 6 drops do something awesome together, because more likely either you're not going to be able to cast your 2 6 drops the same turn when your opponent is doing their synergistic thing, or those 6 drops are just going to be stapled to a 7/7 creature that's going to just kill your opponent before the cool synergistic thing even matters.
That's a great way to put it too. Yeah, if you have a bunch of absolute power level floating around on cards that otherwise have supposed synergies, a lot of times the synergies won't matter because you just have enough absolute power level that you just kill your opponent with your big creature that, sure, it's got this triggered ability that is why you put it in your deck maybe, but that's actually what matters right now. Right now it has power and toughness, and that's all that actually matters. So that's another way just to like emphasize synergy, emphasize combining cards that are worth more when combined than the sum of their parts, is by making sure they don't have this like absolute power level floor of being just great. This ended up being way, I feel like I prepared so much and yet this ended up being so scatterbrained and not that clear.
I think this is a really unclear topic. I mean, so here's something that I'm thinking about is just sort of this difference between optimal curve of a effective deck in an environment versus the curve of the environment. And it kind of seems like we could say, here's the environment, it's this stone block, and we could carve out that optimal deck. And the things that we carved off, maybe those don't actually matter. Maybe I could just take regular cube here and just cut off a bunch of these 4 and 5 drops that aren't really necessary. But I think then you'd be changing the environment that you're drafting from. So you would, even though you're cutting things that seem like they don't matter, you would be changing what the optimal curve is. Because, you know, if we think about it in the opposite, if I went and just said, well, I'm going to add a bunch more 4 and 5 drops, let's put Inferno Titan in here, I don't think the optimal curve would be as low anymore. If you just added more of those big impactful spells, it would change things. And I think that just makes everything very complicated, where we can't just say, like, your curve doesn't match the list, so something is wrong. Like, all these things are connected in a way that is inseparable.
Yeah, I guess if I could try and put a tidy bow on it.
You don't have to.
I'm going to try. Okay. I think the one like actionable advice I can give that I have learned from myself from my own cubes is that look at the cards with the highest absolute power level in your cube, which are very likely to be the things that cost the most mana, and make sure they are play patterns that you love and really want in your cube, right? When I look at Titania, Protector of Argoth, I'm like, this card is awesome. Like, I am so happy to have someone pop off with this card and just do broken things, because kind of in an Archfiend of If in your way, it demands that you like jump through some hoops and stuff. And there was a time where because I was following, I don't know what the cube community more broadly was doing, or like precedent set by other cubes, kind of had a bunch of interchangeable, like, you know, 5 mana planeswalkers in green. And it's like, do I really love any of these cards? And turns out Nissa Who Shakes the World was one that I loved, and the rest I didn't love at all. And so I'll cut all the rest of them. And turns out that deck really only needs the one for it to still do the thing that you expect that deck to do. So I would look very carefully at your high absolute power level cards and make sure that they are contributing to the types of games you want way more so than your low absolute power level stuff, right? I think there's way more leeway in like having a card that maybe doesn't fit your goals, but has a relatively low absolute impact on the game because it's low absolute impact. So yeah, okay, you got a little spell that maybe doesn't quite fit, but it's fine because it's only going to affect so much as opposed to a card that is going to completely change the texture of the game as soon as it resolves. The other thing I would say is that, to your previous point, I think very often in cubes, at least in my experience drafting other people's cubes and looking at other people's sideboards, the cards you see in the sideboard that are on color are the other expensive things they just couldn't fit in the deck. So while you do have a bunch more in the cube list and you're saying, well, if it cut away half, doesn't that change the decks? Not if that half is already in the sideboard, and then just only give them access to the ones that you really like the play patterns of, and then their sideboard is free to be not just the expensive spells that they can't really fit in their curve. Because again, your players should not be thinking this way. They should only be thinking, I need a curve that's going to work. They should be thinking purely relatively power level wise. I think us as designers are the ones that are responsible for thinking in this different way. And it's so hard to describe ways that cube designers, I think, should think differently than players, because there's so much entrenched bias from evaluating cards like a player, because that's what every Magic player has done for all of time. And we're only now, I think, just starting to describe language and approaches to the game that are removed from that perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting and worth noting that when Wizards are designing cards initially, I think they just don't have costs at all. They're just like, let's see how these cards line up. Let's just play them one at a time and see what these effects do and how these mechanics play. And is this fun? And later on, they go and even like roughly try and put costs on things.
Yeah, and then development will further tweak and tune those numbers as they actually play and figure out where things should go from that player perspective. But yeah, I don't know. I guess that kind of thinking of like, just put these cards in play and see, is this the kind of game I want? I don't see a lot of cubes that feel like the designers have done that. I see a lot of cubes where the designers say they want this and that and that, and it's like, okay, well, you're just have Inferno Titan now. So everything you wanted is, it's Inferno Titan. I hope that's what you wanted, because that's all that matters in this game now.
And if it is what they wanted?
Then great. You've great. Done it. So, okay, last thing. I do think, while I don't hear a lot of people saying, I want an environment where you just resolve Inferno Titan and you win, blah, blah, blah. I do think a lot of people...
What's blah, blah, blah? You won.
I do think a lot of people want an environment where sometimes you can do that if you work hard, and your reward is you get to resolve Inferno Titan. And that makes a lot of sense, and I do see that sometimes. And that is not what I'm trying to describe here. But I do see that sometimes where like the goal is, yeah, I want them in the cube, because that's how I want games to end if and when you get to the point where you deserve to end the game, which is different from them just being so abundant that things just kind of turn on a dime. Blech, classic messy episode. Emma, you were dearly missed. This would have been a very different episode if you were here and we were talking about your peasant cube. Anyway, that's it for this episode of Lucky Paper Radio. You're going to hear this the week that we are heading to Madison for KubeCon. We'll put out a little bonus episode, I think, just maybe the day KubeCon starts, reviewing the coverage schedule, letting you know when we'll be streaming so you can tune in live from wherever you are to partake in the fun as much as possible. And then, yeah, no more KubeCon talk for a while. Well, maybe we'll do a recap. But then after that, no more KubeCon talk
recap,
for a while.
And then how we're going to edit our cubes based on KubeCon feedback. And then three other topics
there
based on just us playing a lot of cube.
All of our music is produced by DJ James Nasty. All the Magic cards are produced by Wizards of the Coast. This podcast is produced by me making a bunch of notes and thinking I really had this kind of nailed down, and then starting to talk about it and just feeling like, oh, I guess not. I guess it's all a big mess. Oh, well.
You did great. Look at those graphs.
Thanks for tolerating my semi-structured ramblings, Anthony.
Thanks for having me here to do that.
Great.
We're doing great.
So great.